Paul Hansen, and the title of this session deals with religion and political violence in Lebanon, the failure of cultural pluralism. Okay, last time we were looking at Iran and the influence of Shiism there. This sort of, I felt, naturally led on from Iran if we were moving around the Middle East, because it's the one other country in which both the Shiite brand of fundamentalism has been strongest and has been affected by the events that went on in Iran, and yet is a kind of bridge transition into the Arab world. Remember now, the Persians are not Arabs, and from there we could proceed to other Arab countries in the session on Saturday. Lebanon, as we were just talking a moment ago, 20 years ago was probably seen as the most idyllic country in the Middle East. It was envied for its economic prosperity, beautiful climate. Certainly, financially, it was kind of the Switzerland of the Middle East. It was also a resort playground where all of the people from the Arab world would go. It was a natural confluence, a meeting of East and West. It was the most westernized of the Arab countries, and it was also the place in which Westerners felt most comfortable when they came and visited from that direction. It was also the place where, as I say, rich sheikhs would come up from Saudi Arabia, where they were rather confined in the kind of pleasures they could indulge in, and they could enjoy themselves in discos in Beirut and elsewhere. As I say, a very enviable place to be. I fortunately, in fact, got to visit Lebanon before 1975 myself, and I saw it as something that really seemed to be atypical from many of the other Middle Eastern countries in so many ways. You saw it, if you looked on modernization, for example, as an indice of where other states were going, that it was obviously so much further than the others ahead. And then in 1975, it all begins to disintegrate, and the disintegration has continued for now almost 15 years until today. It seems to be then such a extreme case of going from the penthouse to the outhouse, you know, in just a brief period of time. And I suppose what one question that would come to mind is this condition that Lebanon is currently in the anomaly, or was the previous condition the anomaly? Which is the norm, or which would make more sense, which is more difficult to explain? What's happening now, or the fact that it seemed to have a period in which everything seemed to be working very well? Lebanon as a country is even smaller than Israel, which is a very small country. It is a country that in width is about 50 miles or so wide. You go north to south, it's not much more than 100 miles or so. Not a very big piece of turf. It is, however, a very mountainous piece of turf. And that's probably the best explanation for the kind of population that you find there. It is a kind of crossroads in the Fertile Crescent, but it's a crossroads that is steeped with high mountains, inaccessible valleys, mountains as high as Mount Lebanon, in which, again, over 20 years ago, they opened up ski resorts, snow all year round up there on Mount Lebanon. And as a mountain refuge area, it was a region in which small persecuted groups could find a refuge. They could get up there in the hills in one or another of these valleys and carve out a society for themselves and usually not be disturbed by the powers that dominated the plains and the river valleys, because it certainly just wasn't worth their time and effort to go back up into those valleys and up into those mountains and try to do something about these people. And besides, if they stayed up there and minded their own business, who cared? Then you add to that the crossroads nature of this. The ancient part of Lebanon along the coast was, of course, known as Phoenicia way back in ancient times, a place renowned for its merchant activity and for seafaring that controlled much of the whole eastern Mediterranean. So you can combine the strategic location down there on the coast with the kinds of populations that could exist then up in the hinterlands, and you're going to get a very diverse group that comes and goes all the time too, and there would be residual communities and influences that would come that way as well. Lebanon, as far as developing anything resembling a national identity, however, was, and probably you could even argue today, is a kind of a difficult proposition to even imagine. One thing to remember about the entire area of the Arab Middle East there, countries like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, how long have those countries been in existence as sovereign states? Well, for Israel, you know it's only since World War II, but even for all of the others, it's been only since World War I. Before World War I, all of that area was governed by the Ottoman Empire, in fact, including Egypt, and there were no separate nationalistic identities there. There arguably could be said to be nothing even resembling Syrian nationalism or Iraqi nationalism or any of those kinds of subcategories in the 1920s or so. Lebanon was created as a country. And in fact, the boundaries of all of those countries were created not by Arabs, but by essentially Britain and France. Of the many secret deals that were going on during World War I about what should happen after the war, a lot of divvying up of the post-war pie was going on in secret agreements during the war. One of them was between England and France, in which both wanted to extend and maintain what they perceived to be their interests in the Middle East, and therefore they made an arrangement by which those interests could be secured after the war, which they then proceeded to put in effect through the auspices of the League of Nations, which was established as part of the peace treaty. The French were interested in the area of Lebanon and Syria, and that was the area they wanted to control. The reason for this is that back in the 19th century, they had established a close connection with the largest Christian community in Lebanon, the Maronite Christians. And throughout the 19th century, had frequently used the interests of this community to intervene in the affairs of the Ottoman Empire and to put pressure on the Ottoman Empire as the nominal sovereign of this territory, that coastal strip, which we now call Lebanon, which was the homeland of this Christian community. It's because of the geography that I mentioned that the area of Lebanon contains the largest percentage of Arab Christians anywhere in the Middle East. As I said, it was essentially because these people were able to retreat when Islam came in and be secure in their mountain fastnesses without being forced to accommodate themselves to the succession of Islamic governments that tended to dominate the surrounding areas. The reason the French got involved with the Maronites and the Maronite Christians, that's how you spell them up there, the Maronite Christians are named after a Syrian monk, St. John Maron, who died 410 or so, who was persecuted, whose followers were persecuted by the Byzantine Empire, and that's when they went back up there. But when the Crusaders came out in the 11th and 12th centuries, these Maronite Christians from up in Lebanon there made contact with them, and at that time made an alliance that connected them up with Western Christendom. They acknowledged the supremacy of the papacy, the only group of Eastern Christians that did that. And that was going to give them some kind of security, they hoped, in the long run. Naturally, the Crusader rule proved to be a kind of interim period here, so those links were broken, but they were reestablished then in the 16th and 17th centuries, and the French then took it as their particular province to protect this community beginning in the 18th and 19th centuries. Let me just talk a little bit about some of these other communities, too, as long as I've got them on the board. What this refers to, by the way, is the percentages of these various communities inside Lebanon as they were in the last census that was taken in Lebanon. Now, the key there is the last census that was taken in Lebanon. Guess when the last census taken in Lebanon was? 1932. There has not been a census in Lebanon since 1932 because everybody knows that these numbers have changed a lot and nobody, especially over here, wants to see those numbers. So this census became the basis of a whole series of rather jerry-built political arrangements which precariously enough held on until 1975 and then went, boom, down like a house of cards. So anyway, in 1932, the Maronite Christians, the biggest single group in all of Lebanon, amounted to about still less than one-third of the whole population. There were other Christians, and so there was a Christian majority by lumping together Greek Orthodox, 10%, Greek Catholics, again, a group who in the 18th century had abandoned the Orthodox group here and had sworn allegiance to Rome. The Armenians, most of whom had come during the Armenian Holocaust of World War I from what was then Turkey, that part of the Ottoman Empire. And other, this would include various Protestant groups, the Jacobite Christians, Syrian Christians, there are a variety of, we could get another list actually of 7 or 8 different Christian groups that just fit in the 2% here. A couple of these are a little bit misleading. They're called Greek Orthodox Christians because they by history, followed the Greek Orthodox Church, but they are under the old Patriarch of Antioch, who now resides in Damascus. And their liturgical language is Arabic. All the clergy are Arabs. The Greek is really just a historical designation. These are purely Arabs, these Greek Orthodox Christians, and as I say, are Arab in culture and language, and in their worship group too. They've lived many years with Muslims. These have been the Christians who've tended to live down on the coast, on the cities, and become much more assimilated with. The Maronites were the ones up in the mountains, up in the hills. And as a result, even when you talk about Christian versus Muslim factionalism and sectarian fighting in Lebanon, that really doesn't explain it all either, because very frequently this so-called group of Greek Orthodox have aligned themselves with various Muslim groups, more often than not than with the Maronites. Greek Catholics I just mentioned, and the Armenians, so we can pass those by. And you know these two groups over here, Sunnis and Shias, from previous talks that we've had about that, but this group probably is new to you, the Druze. The Druze are one of those groups that could only have survived in Lebanon. They are an 11th century offshoot of one of the more radical branches of Shiism, one of those sevener branches, for those of you who've been to some of the other earlier sessions, in which a particular Shia caliph in Egypt was turned into the divine incarnation by this group of people who preached up there in the hills, and a whole variety of rather crazy beliefs began to be associated with this figure. They were certainly seen as heretics by Muslims as well as both Sunnis and Shias. I mean, they were like an offshoot of a radical offshoot of a radical offshoot, and they'd gotten so far away that anybody, for example, who claims to be divine is automatically a heretic anyway in Islam. And they evolved a whole set of very secret and esoteric doctrines, ways in which they interpreted the Quran in very allegorical terms to justify many of these things and so forth. And they looked for the return of this 11th century figure in a kind of messianic fashion to bring justice to the whole world. They're very mysterious, in fact, about their texts and this secret esoteric knowledge. In fact, there are no good books to find about Druze doctrine because the Druze keep this very quiet. These are some of the generalizations about them that have filtered out. So what you can see here, and if you have cleverly added this up, by the way, to 99%, there were in Lebanon in 1932 about 1% Jews too, who have since, of course, left and gone to Israel. And these are only rough approximations, but that'll round it off to the nearest percentage. It gives you roughly those divisions in 1932. In 1943, and by the way, this census then was taken by the French, who during the 1920s and 1930s then were the controlling political power in Lebanon and Syria as a result of having the mandate from the League of Nations. They were theoretically preparing the Lebanese and the Syrians for self-government under the mandates, but in many cases these mandates were being used primarily for as cloaks for a new type of colonial control. The longest lasting of these mandates is just being hopefully ended now, which is South Africa's, which had grabbed that mandate over Namibia and has held on to it ever since, long after the League of Nations, which granted that mandate, disappeared. In any case, then, the French conducted this census. And then during World War II, when the French were obviously in dire straits, their country occupied by the Germans, their ability to hold on to Lebanon and Syria, obviously very much in doubt, the various Lebanese factions made a pact, what is called the National Pact in 1943, which essentially amounted to a power-sharing agreement, which was, by the way, an oral agreement. It was never anything put on paper, but it was the leading politicians in each of these categories got together and made up this pact. And essentially, it provided for the fact that the Maronite Christians, as the largest single group, would always have the president. The Sunnis, as the second largest group, would have the prime minister. And the Shias would be the Speaker of the House. We went on down the line. Various other offices were apportioned to other people. All the seats in the legislature were apportioned proportionately according to this census. And by the way, it went down all the way down to handing out government jobs like postal clerks, you know, all on this quota system, and who gets what. The shares are all divided up. The Lebanese political system under this kind of operation is another thing that is necessary to understand to see what happens later, too. And that's that because of the way in which Lebanon is geographically, the isolation of various places, and the fact that in most or another of these places, one or another of these groups dominates. It's not a village which will have, you know, one of this or one of that. There'll be a Maronite village, there'll be a Druze village, and so forth. The large landowners in these particular areas became the most powerful political figures as well. They're called, in Lebanese, the Lebanese term for these are the, Zaims is what they're called. And probably the best translation of this in the Lebanese context is to look on them as political bosses. To be a Zaim, a boss, you had to have wealth on the one hand and political power, political position. And the two, of course, went hand in hand. And you could use the one to acquire the other. With your private wealth, you could grant loans, give jobs to people, give gifts, build a whole large clientele. If you had a position in the political structure, you could, of course, cut red tape for people, shave the law if they needed it. Having lived in Chicago for 7 or 8 years under His Honor the Mayor, I know how you could get traffic tickets fixed and things like that. I mean, it operated essentially like the Chicago political machine in a lot of ways, did in the old days. Pork barrel projects, you could get those kinds of combinations. So that what you had within each of these communities then were a number of these Zaims, who often were bitter rivals with themselves and who jockeyed for influence and position within the community. After all, a Maronite Christian gets to be president, but which Zaim? Which faction? In some cases, some of the more powerful Zaims had their own goon squads, bodyguards, which later on they simply enlarged to create private armies. And that's, you know, what a lot of Lebanon operates on today. The Jemail family, the man whose term expired now as Prime Minister, Amin Jemail, who you may have heard of, remember that earlier in the 80s, his elder brother had been elected and then assassinated, and then he'd taken over. But their father, Pierre Jemail, is one of the big Zaims in Lebanon. And he had started way back in the 1930s a group called the Falange, which was frankly modeled after Franco's operation. It was very fascist in its orientation. They wore black shirts and all these kinds of things as well. And it's quite indicative of the kind of roughshod power that these guys would hold over their particular little pieces of turf throughout Lebanon. So the picture I want to give to you here of Lebanon is not only do we have a large number of groups, but within each of those groups we have highly personalized factions. And we have a very shaky agreement here that was made in wartime that was done to try to create some semblance of unity against the French, because they still needed to be pushed out after the war, but would certainly not work if not everybody followed the rules. All you need are a few people to start backing out of this, and the system is going to collapse. Why does the system last as long as it does, I suppose? There were a few close calls all along the way. One of the close calls that almost precipitated the collapse of the system even before 1975, again, some of you in this room, like me, who have longer memories, were around a little longer, might remember 1958. I can still remember. I was relatively young then, but I remember looking at the paper and seeing this picture of United States Marines going ashore on a nice white sandy beach. And something, the headline was something like, To the Shores of Tripoli. Well, Tripoli, you may know, is an important city in Lebanon to the north of Beirut. And these were U.S. Marines landing in Lebanon in 1958. Eisenhower sent in the Marines to Lebanon in 58, so maybe Reagan was looking backward and thinking, well, he could do it, maybe I can do it. In 1958, the threat that was coming to Lebanon, and to the Christian president who asked Eisenhower to send in the Marines, the threat was coming from Arab nationalism. Arab nationalism, particularly under the stimulus of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the very charismatic president of Egypt at the time. Everywhere throughout the Arab world at this time, young Arab men were tremendously enthused by the things they were hearing on Radio Cairo, which with 100,000 watts was broadcasting clear across the entire Arab world. And they were being encouraged to get rid of pro-Western neo-colonialist governments who cooperated with the West and strike out for pan-Arabism and unite all the Arab peoples together under Nasser's leadership. And with the murder of a editor of a pro-Nasser paper in Lebanon, large-scale demonstrations began among many of the Muslim youth in Lebanon, and the Maronite president was so worried that he called in Eisenhower to send in the troops. This was a kind of, I suppose, charitably enlarged interpretation of the Truman Doctrine, in which we would promise to help any state which said that it was under threat of subversion, because subversion in the 1950s meant only one kind of subversion. It had to be, you know, communist kind of subversion, and so it could pass for that. Anyway, the Marines came in. A few people were locked up. The threat passed. Certain agreements were made, negotiations, and the lid was put back on for a while, and Beirut and Lebanon boomed in the 60s. And then as oil wealth started to come in, became the banking center for this, and as I say, everything looked to be going very, very well all through the early 70s as well. But in 1975, okay, the Civil War breaks out. Well, what has happened to cause this? Well, for one thing, of course, these proportions changed dramatically over this period. I would say, again, you can only come up with guesstimates, but I would say if you were to look at it now, charitably, it would be 60-40 in terms of the percentages of population. And by far the largest single group in Lebanon today are the Shiites, who probably are close to 40% of the population themselves. Anyway, again, you get estimates between 33%, one-third to 40%. How many people are we talking about? 4 million? Something like that.
What language or languages are used there?
Arabic is the language of all of these people. For the most part, linguistic divisions don't enter in. We are talking about Christian Arabs here. And so that's not a problem. Nice that they have one common language they can insult each other in, at least, I suppose. Proportion of population grew, as I say, fastest with the Shia. One of the reasons, by the way, was certainly the differences in birth rates. And from what we know, virtually anywhere in the world, the greater your prosperity, the higher your standard of living, your birth rate begins to drop. The poorest people in Lebanon, the people at the very bottom of the ladder in socioeconomic terms, the Shiites. This compartmentalization of people into groups was furthered, in fact, by the educational system in Lebanon, in which private education has about two-thirds of the pupils in Lebanon, and public education only about a third. In other words, each of these confessional communities preferred to send their children to certain kinds of private schools, which would enforce their insularity, if you will, but also ensured that there was no real mixing. Maronite Christians, because of their traditional connection with the French, tended to send theirs to French schools, and they became French-speaking. The Greek Orthodox and the Greek Catholics more frequently to Protestant schools. The American University in Beirut educated many of the elite here on the Christian side, especially, though it was open to others. But the Shia, as the poorest group, were sort of left in the public schools, and you almost have a similar situation to you have in many large urban cities, in which the poorest minorities populate the public schools, and because there is no particular lobbying, therefore, to improve the public schools, because other people are sending their children to private schools, those schools stay in a fairly mediocre level, and that also hurt the Shiites. But in any case, they were growing in terms of numbers. Another factor would include over here, again, any of you who are from Southern California area like I am know that there are a lot of Lebanese left Lebanon. A lot of Lebanese left Lebanon. You can go to Detroit area, for example, and there's another large Lebanese community. In fact, in a town I grew up in Mason City, Iowa, our next door neighbor was a Lebanese grocer. They went in many different places, but almost all of the Lebanese who emigrated were Christian Lebanese of one kind or another. So that the population is not only getting out-migration here, but also has a lower birth rate, so the proportions are changing even more rapidly as a result of the combination of those things. The other factor that has happened here by 1975 is that Lebanon could not involve tragic entanglement with the Arab-Palestinian issue. And one of the things that's often not noted about the Arab-Palestinian issue is the fact that it has profoundly affected not just the region of Israel-Palestine, but all of the surrounding countries to a great degree as well. When after the 1967 war, and Israel had occupied the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai, large numbers of Palestinians became double refugees. That is, some who had fled in 48 to the West Bank fled in 67 to Jordan or to Lebanon. That it was in those camps that, of course, the PLO was born in the 60s and became particularly powerful in the late 60s. Most of those camps were in Jordan in the late 60s. And the PLO in those camps became so powerful, began to conduct raids across the border into Israel, that King Hussein in Jordan suddenly found himself in a very precarious situation. Israel would retaliate for these raids. He and his forces were taking a beating in the crossfire, and there was also some worry, in fact, that the Palestinians would take over Jordan, would take over the state, depose King Hussein. The result was for what the Palestinians called Black September, when the Jordanian army was unleashed by King Hussein against the Palestinians to try to drive them out of Jordan. Many of those who were driven out of Jordan went to Lebanon. And so what you had happening, and this was in 1970, so what you had happening in the early 1970s is 200,000 or 300,000 Palestinians flowing into Lebanon. Palestinians who are almost all Sunni, or they're all Muslims for the most part. There are a few Christians, but by and large, that's going to put this half of the equation even heavier there on the Muslim side. Well, this became an extremely combustible mix then. The Palestinians had to elbow space for themselves among these groups which were already crowded in among each other cheek by jowl. The Palestinians were well financed, had weapons, were able in fact sometimes to take over some of the lands that some of these people had adjacent to camps or elsewhere, and particularly those who lived in the south of Lebanon, which tended, by the way, to be primarily Shiite, found themselves and their villages being used as bases from which Israel could be attacked, and the Israelis naturally retaliating, and again, this population being caught in the crossfire. That kind of brings me to a point where I want to show you a little bit of tape again about what tended to happen then in terms of creating a revival among the Shiites and among the Muslim groups here once the civil war broke out. I'm not going to get into all of the people who joined sides in various kinds of coalitions, but I think I've just laid out enough factors so that you can see it was quite a volatile situation, and the Palestinians in some ways were simply the straw that broke the camel's back, that the kindling effect to bring this whole system crashing apart. So let me run some tape here, if you can turn around here.
The Shia were the shepherds and farmers of the hills of the south, poor, underprivileged, downtrodden. Numerically, they were the majority, but it counted for nothing.
Stop there. There's more, but we won't have time to look at the whole of that. By the way, I've got quite a few tapes along with me here, and I don't know if people are interested. We could arrange some evening sessions if you'd like to see some of these things in more detail, but maybe it's possible to, at some odd time or another, to, when this room isn't being used, to come in at least and look at the tapes if you're interested. What we have in Lebanon then, since this was done, is continued growth of Shia power, but factionalism again becoming a problem. In particular, what you have, they mentioned the Amal militia that had emerged as the strongest force. Since that time, a more radical group known as Hezbollah, or the Party of God, has emerged as a more radical alternative even to Amal. Amal seemed to be primarily interested in establishing the Shia as the dominant group within the old Lebanese power-sharing system. They simply wanted to take into account their numbers as now being dominant to give them a much better share of the whole pie. But Hezbollah has been much more influenced by the Iranian Revolution and speaks instead in terms of an Islamic state under Shia domination and as part of the whole uniting the whole Islamic world under Islam again, and you know, idolizes or has looked to Khomeini as the model here, and a couple of the Shia leaders in Hezbollah have been playing roles that are quite analogous to that of Khomeini, and have used rhetoric that is quite similar as well. Hezbollah is an interesting grouping in that it is not an organized party. It's a kind of umbrella group which has subsumed, like the PLO originally was too, which has subsumed a number of different smaller radical factions, each of which continue to operate quite independently. It has no hierarchy. There's no one who's an acknowledged head of it. There seem to be, in fact, separate kinds of cells who autonomously do what they wish. Most people believe that the kidnappings that have been done of American citizens in Beirut have been done by various groups who claim allegiance to Hezbollah, but part of the problem and the frustration of dealing with or trying to get information about these hostages or trying to deal with someone in relationship to that is that Hezbollah has no structure. Who do you go to? Who do you talk to? We've been trying to work through Iran because presumably Iran has some kind of influence with Hezbollah, but as I said, it's such a factionalized and unorganized type of thing. In fact, you become a member of Hezbollah essentially by declaring your allegiance to it or identifying with those kinds of ideas and sentiments that it's been difficult to do anything more about it. If you look at the conditions then which seem to be rather grim in terms of their forecast, that are seem to preclude any kind of settlement and would seemingly call upon continuing violence in Lebanon. You have the fact that there is now no central government with any power or legitimacy in Lebanon. In fact, the fiction of the Jemayel government has now stopped because there was supposed to be a new president elected in the fall of 88, and no one could agree on who that should be. Traditionally, that would have been selected by the parliament. Instead, we have two people claiming to be prime minister, two people claiming to be members or heads of defense forces, which actually make no difference anyway, because the Lebanese army disintegrated once the civil war happened as people went off into their various factions. So there's no military force that the state can call upon. As a result, it's been tempting for outsiders to come in and try to settle it. Syrians have been actively involved in Lebanon since 1976, and the Israelis, as you've seen, have in various ways tried to influence events in Lebanon. But it's been a quagmire for any outside power to come in, because the number of confrontations and antagonisms is so many-sided that it's almost impossible to unravel the tangle. You have ideological confrontations of modernizing groups of people versus people who would like to turn the clock back, pro-Iranian versus pro-Syrian, and it gets into all kinds of Middle Eastern politics as well. And then now what you've done is quite similar to what has happened in places like Northern Ireland, is that you have raised an entire generation of young men in their 20s who have known nothing but war, and whose idea... In fact, that's where the tape continues. It follows a 14-year-old soldier around in his daily round here in Beirut, is where the tape continues from this, who see death all the time, have become totally inured to it to a large degree, and whose idea now of honor is, of course, retaliation and revenge. The polarization has become so extreme, it's difficult, given the fact that this country never was one that was very well integrated, to see how it can all be put back together again. Partition, well, I mean, it's an awfully small place as it is. Certainly Syria would like to take it over. It traditionally has seen Lebanon as part of the greater Syrian sphere of influence and felt that it was a simply arbitrary decision to lump this coastal bit off just to protect the Christians anyway, that historically it should have been part of Syria. So there are various people who have their own agendas here, and it's difficult to see where it's going to end from now. But right now it's very clear that the example of the Iranian revolution and the power that the Shiites have gained as a result of, and the confidence they've gained as a result of not only defeating Israel, but also the United States, that's the way they view it, and their size, may mean that in some fashion or other they're going to impose some kind of solution on the part of Lebanon that they control. But it's all up for grabs here. It looks grim, I'm afraid. Questions, comments?
If Lebanon has no army, why are the Shiites controlling only part of it?
Well, because each of these other groups has armies. The Maronites, the Lebanese forces, the Christians have. The Christians, by the way, you remember, came in and massacred the Palestinians in the refugee camps allowed to by the Israelis. Every one of these groups has their own private army, and so that's what the battles are. Yeah.
What is the relationship between the Shia and the Sunni in the groups within the country?
The Sunnis are now split. Why not? Isn't everybody else? There has been a Sunni leader in Tripoli to the north. The Sunnis have been generally concentrated along the coasts in various cities, but in Tripoli, a Sunni leader has emerged that is of the fundamentalist type and has formed an organization called Tahweed, which appears to be trying to cooperate with some of the more radical Shias. However, he has said, they control Tripoli, this radical group. He said, however, I want an Islamic Lebanon too, but I don't want it to be only a Shia Lebanon. I want it in accordance with, you know, his version. So ultimately down the road, although they in the short run, they have more in common than not, there could be a clash between Sunni and Shia fundamentalists too. The other group of Sunnis have been part of the establishment. They've been people like the Maronites who have shared power and who have often wanted to preserve that. They could see threats coming from the Shiite as well, this part of the Sunni establishment. And so in many cases, they have been allies with the Maronites, this group of Sunnis. The Druze traditionally, led by a couple of families, have tended to be among the more radical groups too, but they've been more radical in a political sense. Now, here's another thing, you know, that's in there. We've got capitalists versus socialists, Marxists, and other things. A lot of the Druze leaders have tended to espouse various forms of socialism, and have been radical in their social policies, but not closely connected with the Sunnis. Yeah.
So, is this really a religious conflict?
Well.
That's an excellent point.
The thing is that people in Lebanon are identified as members of religious groups. Your identity card in Lebanon lists your sect, and that identifies you. It puts you into a category. And ironically enough, even if you, out of conviction, were to change religions, it would be very difficult to change your identity card. Because you are born, as far as most people are concerned, into a particular sect, and it's identified in religious terms. But until the Shiites arose with the ideology encouraged from Iran, there wasn't a lot of fighting for the faith as such. It's just that these are people divided by religious communities who are fighting over the same old things, power, economic status, and that sort of thing. But this is the way people see it. That is, I am fighting as a member of a religious group. But just as in Northern Ireland, I mean, the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland aren't fighting over doctrinal questions there. They're fighting over power, but they identify themselves as members of one or another religious group, and therefore it sometimes gets viewed as a religious conflict from that perspective.
Paul,
yes?
Given all the turmoil over there, how do they solve daily affairs? Who takes out the garbage?
It's amazing. It's amazing the capacity that people have to cope and what the Lebanese have learned to do. I mean, there will be like the green line that divides the sectors in Beirut between Christian and Muslim. Sometimes there'll be truces called that you'll find out that, well, for 2 hours you'll be able to cross the green line, go get something in the shops, if there is anything in the shops, and, you know, more or less people will understand. But you'll see people living in apartments in which one wall is missing, you know, it's bombed out. People adjust to amazing conditions.
You think of the systems that go into sustaining society, water, sewer, food, you know, with all the groups.
And it's on a very makeshift basis, but it's surprising what people do. And this has been, you know, true if you looked at bombed out Berlin in 1945, or, you know, any place where you think, probably next to cockroaches, I suppose human beings are the most adaptable, I mean, in terms of being able to survive almost any kind of thing that you don't think is survivable. They figure out ways to do it.
How are they supporting the war?
A lot of the support, obviously, is outside interests who want to back one faction or another because it's in their political interest to do so. For example, the Israelis have been backing various Christian military groups and using them as surrogates. They in fact, bankroll a whole militia in South Lebanon right along the border there, as a way of keeping a buffer zone between them and the Shia. Other Arab money has come in from the oil coast. Iran certainly has helped finance the Shias. Gaddafi has had some money poured into Lebanon. There are always people who are willing to finance for various kinds of political aims. You know.